Today, we are joined by Hivemapper CEO, Ariel Seidman. Ariel, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Brad.
For sure. It has been a little while since we last spoke, but there's been a lot of developments, a lot of new changes, very exciting things happening. We're going to touch on all that. Of course, I think most people are going to want to know about the B. We will talk about all the nitty-gritty details there, but definitely want to talk about the demand side, because I would say Hivemapper is one of the few projects in the DeFi space right now that's truly seeing revenue and token burns and some exciting new contracts. But before we get into all of that, for people that are watching for the first time, I'd love for you to give us a little bit about your background and what you were doing leading up to Hivemapper.
Sure. So my name's Ariel, CEO and co-founder of Hivemapper. I've been in and around the mapping world basically for 20 years now. So really my first job out of school was at Yahoo when it was still fun to be at Yahoo. So I sat in the Yahoo search group. We had about 30% market share. Google had roughly like 32, 35% market share. So we were still very much neck and neck. And a massive percentage of the daily queries on Yahoo search were related to local, right? And so this could be like a local pizza shop. This could be like, how do I get from here to here? This could be, I want to understand more about this, country or region of the world or whatever it may be. And so then I took ownership of all those type of queries and then ultimately ran Yahoo Maps, which at its peak had about 90% market share. And then Google Maps came around and they started to really like just plow, just crazy amounts of money into building their map. And quite frankly, just took a lot of market share from us. And I had a front row seat to that. So I was able to kind of see and understand how they built the map. And, while they did a good job, it was definitely over-engineered and it was a very, very expensive way to build the map. And I think there's a, especially now in this era with all the new technologies, tools, distribution, ubiquitous computing, all that, there's a new way to go build a map from the ground up. And I think even Google, I think if they were doing it today, they would do it quite differently. And so that's the opportunity with Hivemapper, is like, how do you build a new, fresher, more cost-effective way to build a map from the ground up?
That all makes a lot of sense, especially that you have the background in mapping. I'm sure that has been really helpful in Hivemapper's success, especially talking about the revenue. And that's what I'm going to talk about next. If you could touch on the different categories, the opportunities when it comes to revenue.
So there's three major categories. I mean, there's two that are active right now. So there's data solutions, right? So we have a host of, various API data products. We go out to other businesses that want access to that data and some of those APIs. This can be another mapping company. This can be a logistic company. This can be a transportation company, commercial real estate, autonomous vehicle company, et cetera. So that's data solutions. There's a new product called Beekeeper, which is going after, quite frankly, just a much larger market in commercial fleets, right? And so there's 250 million to 300 million commercial vehicles in the world. And all of those commercial fleets, obviously, they're doing routes throughout the entire day. They're going here, they're going there, whatever. They're dropping off stuff, picking up people, et cetera. They want to protect that asset and they want that asset to be incredibly efficient. And so we now have the opportunity to kind of rebuild from the ground up, given that we understand and see the world, something that every other provider in this space just simply doesn't do because they don't have the mapping background. So we're very excited by that part. That's a huge market just getting started now. And then the third one, which is fairly nascent that you're going to see a lot more about next year, is platforms, right? So how do other people utilize our software that called Map AI that actually builds the map, integrate into many more vehicles, both in terms of contributing and consumption? There's a lot more there to talk about. I'm not going to talk about it all today, but that's obviously a big focus of ours on the platform side.
You just announced, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, that you have three new contracts and six-figure contracts, right?
Yeah. Most of these contracts that we're seeing today are in the data solutions category, right? And so these are other businesses integrating various data products into their systems, okay? It could be other mapping companies. I think we've announced one of them, which is called Here Technologies, which is owned by many of the large German car manufacturers like Audi and so forth. So that's one. you know, type of customer. The other is automotive companies. So this is, you know, the Lucids of the world, the Rivians of the world, you know, so you have kind of this new generation of automotive companies, as well as some of the legacy automotive companies as well. And then you have, you know, what I would refer to as a smaller segment for sure, but it's like commercial real estate. We have a lot of like just real estate in general, like local government, those customers as well. That is definitely a smaller segment of the overall data solution. We're also seeing now traction in autonomous vehicles. You know, obviously Tesla's a big player there. Obviously Waymo's a big player there. But what people don't realize is there's AV companies, autonomous vehicle companies, just focus on like trucking as an example, right? But you have a lot of other players as well, right? You have Nero, you have Zooks. You have Mobileye to a certain extent as well. I don't think that it's going to be a Waymo Tesla only game. Obviously, they'll have a significant percentage of market share ultimately if you kind of look out 3 to 5 years, but there will be all these other players as well. We could talk a little bit more about that. So that's where most of the revenue is coming from, is those kinds of categories and those type of customers today.
I'm curious, you know, how those conversations have shifted since you first started with this, because I imagine at the beginning, and not to say you don't still do proof of concepts, but I imagine at the beginning it was kind of pitching this idea. Now you kind of have case studies and a proven product.
Yeah.
So I think those conversations have gotten easier over time.
Yeah, 100%, right? I mean, I think like people look at the scale that we're operating at right now, and I will remember, I mean, this is kind of the funny part of Discord, is like people were like, all those like data evals, this is not this past summer, I think this was like the previous summer, like people were like going off on me and HiveMapper for that matter, basically being like, all those data evals you guys did, like nothing ever came of them, they were all bullshit, you guys failed. You know, and I was looking at it and being like, actually there's like contracts, like there's happening. And so it was kind of like funny. I was like, okay, thank you.
Yeah,
so living in two different worlds at the same time.
You have to remember, most people haven't worked in like the startup space or worked in the business world to the extent of like having to build a product. You start off, you know, with a proof of concept in many cases, get in the door with these businesses and customers, and then you build bigger contracts over time, bigger opportunities over time. In the crypto world, everybody wants everything yesterday, right? So it's hard to kind of get people to wrap their head around that whole concept of actually building something.
I'll give you one example of a customer they started, you know, well, I can't share the specific name, but hopefully we will, because we've been very helpful and valuable to them, which is great news. So they started off with a purchase order, I think in the tens of thousands of dollars. And they thought that it was gonna basically last them for, you know, whatever, like 9 months, 12 months. They basically used all of their credits within about 2 to 3 months. And so they're happy, right? Because they're getting tremendous value out of it. And so now they're like, oh geez, we gotta like work on a much bigger contract for 2025. You know, all right, let's go like, figure out how to scale up, to your point about, yeah, you get in the door, you show the customer that you're really valuable and you're really useful. And I think what we've also learned in terms of the data solutions product is, in addition to just providing like, hey, you can hit our API for all the imagery that you want or all the map features that you want, customers are looking for changes, right? And so they're looking for, hey, you know, tell me about whether or not that speed limit has changed. Tell me about whether or not there's, you know, road construction here. And if so, what's the impact, right? Tell me about whether or not that road construction is now gone, right? And so just think about all the changes that are happening. That is, you know, just honestly like 10 times more valuable than just like a data feed of just massive amounts of data where they then have to kind of sift through and figure out what's interesting within that data feed.
Yeah.
So that's one, you know, really interesting thing that we've learned from our customers. The second thing is there's a lot of customers that are looking for, you know, very abnormal situations. Okay. So this is a good one. You have a school bus, right, with like that little stop sign that comes up dynamically. That's not a persistent stop sign, right? Like to a normal, you know, AV system, that will oftentimes just like look like another stop sign, right? But it's not, it's dynamic. It's not associated. It's not fixed. And so like really being able to understand these nuanced differences in the world is really valuable. Or like, hey, somebody got into an accident in this scenario. That type of data is incredibly valuable to a lot of the autonomous vehicle companies in terms of training their models.
All that makes a lot of sense. And also, and we'll talk more about the B here in a little bit later in this, but having the edge processing, having that data more quickly and more real time, I think I imagine will even make that data product better, right? And open up more doors for you guys on that end.
Oh, 100%. The incremental revenue that is tied to the B is obviously like massive. And I don't think we quite fully appreciate how big it is. Because to your point is, A, it doesn't just lower costs, which was actually like one of the primary reasons we did the B, was we're like, geez, like processing all of this data on the servers on AWS is crazy expensive. So that was like the very, very original motivation for it. Obviously, we also realized we want this real-time data. We want all of the processing at the edge so we can really much more dynamically understand what's going on in the world. We should talk more about what I mean by that, because it does introduce a lot of new revenue opportunities, and we're seeing that play out right now. And so like, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people, understandably so, have been incredibly patient for the B. We want to get this out there, not only because we want to satisfy all the people who did the pre-orders and thank them for their patience, but also because from a revenue perspective, there's a lot of incremental revenue tied to the B.
And by the way, I do want to pull this up because I'm excited about the revenue that's going to be coming, but we've been seeing, I mean, you look at this growth in the honey burns right now. I have a couple other visuals here. This is a good one too that shows the growth over time. And I really like this one because it shows it versus some of the other projects out there from a percentage growth standpoint. But you know, you all are seeing a lot of revenue growth, and that's exactly what you want to see. I mean, to your point though too, and I've seen some people that, you know, they're like, well, how come the burns are going up but the revenue is, you know, kind of up and down? It's like, well, just because you're seeing the tokens being burned, that's the data credits being used. You know, there are going to be companies that buy a lot of data credits at once and then use them over time. So you might see some spikes in revenue, right?
Yeah, I think it's like you have customers that come in, like you definitely have some big customers that come in and, you know, do like fairly sizable orders, and that can spike, you know, and then it kind of goes back to normal. And then you have some new customers that come in, and then boom, they accelerate, right? And then again, you see a spike. So it will smooth out, right? Like, you know, once you have like 50 to 100 big customers, then it will definitely smooth out over time. So I'm not too worried about that. It's just like the normal course of any sort of growth business. You know, the other thing that will smooth this out is Beekeeper, right? Beekeeper is like a different type of, it's a subscription revenue product, and it has different financial implications in terms of all that stuff that we're looking at right now.
And that is actually the next categories.
Yeah, let's talk about Beekeeper.
Okay. So I have it pulled up here. Obviously this is for, you know, fleet management tools, but as opposed to a lot of fleet management tools out there, which by the way, I know a lot of business owners, they pay a lot of money for fleet management tools, but they don't generally have visual aspects to that. So with this, obviously you have a whole new type of data set, new insights you can provide. So yeah, I would love for you to talk about kind of your differentiators versus other fleet management tools and just how big of an opportunity you think this is.
Yeah, no, this is really big. I mean, so let's first define who the customer is and define what their problems are, right? And what they're trying to accomplish. So the customer is anybody, any business with, call it 10 vehicles all the way up to many, many thousands of vehicles, right? You know, the companies that have many, many thousands of vehicles that we all know, right? So that would be like the FedExes of the world, the UPSs, even Pepsi. I think Pepsi has something like 45,000 different vehicles, right? This would be like, you know, bigger trucks, smaller delivery trucks, et cetera. And so the number of vehicles that are attached to a commercial fleet is in the range of 250 million to 350 million globally. So it's a lot. And so what the customer is trying to really solve is a couple of issues. One is, hey, that's an expensive asset that I have, right? That vehicle itself, if it gets into an accident, you have obviously the vehicle itself, but you also have the driver. you know, that could be a catastrophic situation, right? So they're trying, that's about safety, obviously. And so how do you keep the driver in safe situations as much as possible? The second thing they're looking to do is optimize the cost efficiency of it, right? So if you send your driver down a road, which they're going to have to then circle back in because the road is closed, or the that type of vehicle, because it's too high or whatever the case may be, can actually access the delivery point or wherever they need to go, that is an inefficient use of that asset, right? Or even more basic things, hey, that road over there sucks and it's going to tear apart your car, right? Because of all the road construction going on. Here's how you can avoid it, right? And then there's like, hey, if this vehicle is operating in places that it shouldn't be, right? Either the driver is using it for personal reasons, or the driver is taking it into like neighborhoods or places that they shouldn't be going into, you know, I want to know about that, right? And so most of the existing systems today are what I would call nanny cams. So they're just basically there to annoy the driver, but they don't actually provide the driver with intelligence, with an understanding of what's happening. So for example, if you're a truck driver and you got to pull into a weigh station, that inspector can ruin your day and ruin your week, right? Not because you're doing anything wrong, but just they got a thing, they want to cause problems for you, blah, blah, blah. They got, you know, some quota to meet. And so that's issue number one is like, look, if there's a weigh station, they want a way around it, right? They want to know it's open A. And if so, they want the most efficient way around that. Number two is they do have to stop, right? For whatever reason, they want to know, okay, how backed up is it, right? Are there two trucks there? Are there 20 trucks there? That's a meaningful difference in terms of how much time is this going to eat out. So let's talk about this in the context of the B. So the B, you know, it can do all the basic fleet monitoring stuff. That's not that hard, quite frankly. But the really cool part about it is that it can see and understand the world, right? So it can see, okay, that's a truck weigh station. Okay, that's open. Okay, there's 18 trucks there, right? And so it really has that spatial intelligence of what's happening at a very specific location that can then be fed back into that driver that gives them valuable intelligence. So it's not just a nanny cam anymore. It's actually like something they want to use because it's providing them with real utility. And so I think just because of where we started, which was like we're fundamentally a mapping company, we have built this technology that enables us to see and understand the world and then feed that data back into the driver and back into the fleet manager.
Okay. And that's something I do want to dig in more on, because, you know, it has been years now of you all building out these tools, doing the AI training, all of that. So how does that work, that foundation? You touched on it a little bit, but digging a little bit more, how that foundation helps with this new product that you're launching.
Yeah, it's a good question. Okay, so the AI training really serves two purposes. One is they're training all the data, right? So upfront, like in my example of the weigh station, you know, we need to see many, 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 many different examples of what a weigh station looks like, what a weigh station looks like when it's open and so forth. And so all of that is fed into these training models. And the data has been labeled by all these AI trainers that exist on our platform today. And so our cost to actually produce the data and then the speed at which we can do the data as well has rapidly increased, right? So yeah, we launched the AI trainer platform about 2 years ago. And so now it's a much more mature platform, and you can just do a lot more labeling across many more objects and things in the world. So that's step one. Once those models are trained up, you know, utilizing all this label data, then they get deployed to the B, and that will happen over the air, right? So you can start to make changes very quickly, introduce new capabilities very quickly. Okay, so what happens on the B? The B does three things. So the first thing it does is obviously detect objects. So it says, okay, I've been trained to look for speed limit signs or truck weigh stations or billboards or whatever it may be, right? And boom, I got it. That's a speed limit sign. Now we need to then position it, right? So we need to understand where it is in the three-dimensional world with the stereo depth cameras. That's the role of the stereo depth cameras, or one of the roles. The key roles is actually to then position all the objects and understand its relationship relative to everything else. So like a turn restriction sign, if you just know like, oh, there's a turn restriction sign, that's not very helpful. You need to know where it is because you need to know which drive path it's actually associated with. The third piece about it is spatial intelligence. Maybe we'll come up with a better name for it. But the basic idea is, okay, it's nice to know there's a truck weigh station over here. Here is where it's located. But now I want to know whether or not it's open, right? I want to know how many trucks there are, right? And so that's the spatial intelligence piece, which is incredibly valuable. And that's where we're utilizing a lot of the new AI models that have come to bear, is not just, you know, being able to detect objects, position objects, but also build a scene description and an understanding of what's actually happening in that scene. So all that data can be informed and sent back to these drivers and ultimately the fleet managers themselves.
Okay, that's really good context. And this is, again, this is a massive industry. I think it's close to $29 billion industry with fleet management somewhere around there. And I'd expect it's only going to grow. I'll say you're kind of opening the door for a new type of fleet management, I think. And I think with AI especially, having the ability to make this visual data really useful.
Yeah, and we want to work with, you know, for example, there's a company in the logistics space, and they said to us, like, hey, you know, what's really, you know, we'd love to deploy these right on our vehicles. That's A. So, and then they start asking questions, right? It's pretty cool to see, like, hey, you know, what's a big problem for us? We're looking for very specific containers. So they do like a lot of pickups from ports all across the United States. So like, especially like in Southern California, as an example, and then they drive them to like various places throughout Southern California, whether it be a train station or other delivery points, etc. Okay. And so they're like, you know, sometimes we lose track of a very specific container, okay? And so it's somewhere, right? Like where we often, and so the ability to then train these models to look for very specific things so they can find them is really cool, right? And so like you almost can imagine like these like specialized AI agents kind of traveling through these bees looking for very specific things that the customer needs in order to solve an underlying business problem that they have.
And also, I mean, once you work with a business on a niche use case like this, this is something you can take to market with other companies too, right? So that's also pretty cool. And maybe look for like drones and nuclear waste in New Jersey or something. So obviously this fleet manager, the beekeeper, that's a massive opportunity, man.
Can I just want to, because I know a lot of your listeners are, they're just kind of individual contributors. And I think there's this like tension, right? Which is like, hey, they think they're going to like compete. I am not concerned by that. And I say that with 100% sincerity for a lot of reasons. One is, I mean, just take a place like LA, right? To do all of the layers of the map that we want to do, like all the way up to like traffic and stuff like that, we just need a lot more devices, quite frankly. And so, you know, we are nowhere near kind of reaching that saturation point. And even with fleets, you know, and going aggressive with fleets, I don't see that happening where we're going to reach that saturation point. That's number one. Number two is I don't think it's healthy, right, to have a network where it's just 100% commercial fleets. You definitely want those individual contributors. They just come with like a different, you know, set of passions, motivations that I think is really important in terms of just building up a community. So I don't view it as like competitive the way that some other people do. I think that they can both operate and be successful, and they bring different things to the table.
For sure. And, you know, having a little bit of diversification is not a bad thing. Plus individual drivers are like more likely to cover certain regions, certain roads that you might not get with commercial fleets. And the thing I'll add too is for people that are building a fleet, this is, we'll talk more about that when we talk about the B, but this is a huge opportunity, right? You can kind of tackle this from a couple different ways, but A, it's going to be a lot easier to deploy into fleets, but also businesses, because in the past, there's been this kind of layer that you've had to work through with the business owner and then to the individual employees. Well, with the B, it's going to be a lot more seamless. They're just going to have to put it up there. You don't have to train them on the uploading of data, et cetera. But also you can use this tool, this beekeeper tool, as a maybe a sales tool to get deployed with some of these fleets. So I think for entrepreneurs that are looking to build out fleets, this is a game changer as well, in my opinion.
Yeah, 100%. Like I think it's just be a lot. I mean, there's a lot of people that you would, you've said this, you know, to me many times, is like, look, there's certain types of drivers I just can't give the Hivemapper dash cam to because like they just, you know, it just won't work.
Yeah.
So like all of a sudden, yes, the BLT definitely opens up that options where the number of people that you can, you know, onboard into your fleet is just much bigger.
Absolutely. And I think that's good that you addressed that, because I do feel like there was a sentiment there for a little bit that the focus was going completely to commercial fleets and completely away from the individual contributors. So that's certainly not the case. And I do think it's good to have a healthy mix of both moving forward. And I think that's what we'll see. So there's one more category to touch on as far as potential revenue, looking further out.
The third category is platform, right? And so the idea there basically is there's some very early conversations, you know, with automotive companies about integrating the B software, Map AI, into their vehicles, right? So that their vehicles can both become contributors as well as consumers. That will take a while to kind of play out, obviously, because anybody that we're talking to now, we're literally talking to them about their 2029 models.
Yeah.
Right.
That makes sense.
And so there's other types of companies that we're starting conversations with that are upfitters, right? So these are people like, if you go and buy whatever, 1,000 Ford commercial delivery vans from Ford, you then take it to a different company that basically outfits it with all of your technology, with your branding, with all of your little nuanced configurations. So those type of companies are interesting because it's a faster timeline, right? Rather than it being 2029, you know, maybe we can do something with those guys in 2025 or 26, right? Where they're taking the underlying technology that exists within the B and kind of retrofitting it and integrating it much more deeply into the vehicle. And so that's all about platform stuff. So that's one aspect of the platform. There's some other stuff on the platform stuff that I'm going to hold back mentioning because it's a big announcement that we're making with another crypto project in the January timeframe. But I think it'll become clear as to like how that also is another aspect of what we're doing on the platform side.
Okay, cool. Yeah, the automotive industry moves pretty slowly. So I can, you know, 2029, that would make sense with that, you know, 5 years out. But that could be a massive opportunity down the road. So it's good to start having those conversations now, right? The data solutions, fleet management tools, I mean, those are massive opportunities that you can start tackling today. And we're seeing it. That does bring me to one thing I want to bring up real quick, this new MIP. Don't need to talk about this too long, but you guys, that's a 50% increase in the cost of data credits. So that should lead to certainly more revenue, more token burns.
That's true. I mean, the reason that we did it is pretty straightforward, which is like the Map Image API in terms of the amount of value that BMaps Inc. or was previously Hivemapper Inc. Is providing on top of the Hivemapper network is more limited. Right. With something like Beekeeper, we're providing obviously and building a tremendous amount of value on top of the data that we're paying the Hivemapper network for. So there, you know, I think the it'll be a little bit different, but, you know, like let's say we're generating $10, $15, $20 of revenue per device from Beekeeper. You know, I think the split is going to be a little bit different, right? But in terms of the Map Image API, you know, we're obviously adding value on top of it. And then there's a sales cost, the support cost with the customer, all that type of stuff. But in terms of that product itself, you know, we thought it was just appropriate to like, you know, drive more value into the network.
Okay. I mean, I like it, man. Anything that's going to be more revenue, more token burn is a good thing. All right, let's pivot to the B. This is the topic I think most people are going to be interested in. We've got it. Here's the website there. But I also have some pictures here of some manufacturing that you posted. So progress is being made there. And then it looks like the finished product there. So what can you tell us about the B, the manufacturing? How are things looking right now?
Things are looking good. I mean, a lot better than they were back in June timeframe, for sure. In the June timeframe, I'll just like share everything so everyone has the context on this. Yeah, in the like May, June timeframe, things were quite frankly just broken. They weren't working. And throughout the summer, we kind of stuck with it. And then in September, we got more and more devices out there, and the data that it was producing was excellent, right? And so what I described there in terms of being able to detect an object, you know, properly position the object, understand kind of what dry path is associated with, and then add that spatial intelligence around it, started to work. And like, you know, after a while, just kind of looking at the data, it kind of got boring because like, obviously like you're looking for problems in the early days, and it was boring because like there was no problems. I don't want to say no problems, but there was like very few problems, right? And so we're like, all right, this is pretty awesome. So then now the focus has shifted on like, okay, how do we produce these and how do we produce them reliably? How do we produce them cost effectively? You know, how do we make sure that every single one that leaves the manufacturing line has complete and very thorough end of line testing for all the different things that we care about, whether it be GPS or GNSS, whether it be, you know, depth sensing, whether it be compute, whether it be, you know, thermal. So there's just a tremendous amount of work happening, you know, this past month to kind of gear up that production line. So now I want to caution that the production line, like any production line, when you bring it up, there's always going to be little issues, right? Teething issues. Okay. That needs to be fixed or that needs to be fixed, et cetera. So we are definitely not going to hit our full production daily output in December. Okay. Probably not even in January. February is when I think we'll start to hit like our full production, you know, daily output. So the idea is that there are some shipping this month. There will be more shipping in January, right? And then February is when you'll start to really see them kind of flying off the shelves in a much, much, much faster pace, quite frankly.
How does the manufacturing capacity for the B compare to the HTC? Because we talked about this a little bit before, the manufacturing process itself, some of the automation you've added, you know, this time around, it's quite different. And obviously it took some capital investment to get there, but I'm curious, you know, what that manufacturing process looks like and how it differs and then how that can lead to more production.
So I think we hit a peak with the HTCs. We hit a peak of about 200 per day, maybe 250, you know, 225 per day. We haven't proven it yet, but we are cautiously optimistic that we can get it to at least 375, 400, right? Maybe 500. And so that's kind of where we're at in terms of just, and the question is why? And so there's fewer actual overall parts in the actual B than there were in the HTC. Which is kind of crazy, but it's true. and so we've just been a lot more thoughtful in terms of when we're designing this thing, how do we design it for assembly, right? It's not just like we're going to design it. We quite frankly, with HTC, we didn't know exactly like how many orders there were going to be. And so it's kind of crazy to invest a ton of money, you know, in terms of automating everything, if there's only going to be like 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000, right? With this, it was a lot more clear that there was going to be tens of, you know, many, many, many tens of thousands of devices, hopefully hundreds of thousands of devices. So it made a lot more sense to actually spend it, you know, spend the time to do it. There was also, I mean, just kind of get into a little bit more details here. Like in HTC, there was like this glue and it was very tedious to apply. And then like, once you applied it, you had to kind of wait for it to all cure and stuff like that. And so that chewed up a lot of additional time. Then we had issues in terms of, you know, the actual boxing itself, like the boxes that we had for the HTC were really challenging for a robot to actually kind of fold properly. So now we have a box that's much easier for a robot to do. And so literally the robot at the very end of that, of the process can take all the different parts that are going to go into the box. So it's not just about the device itself, but there's, you know, the cord, there's the adapter, you know, the pamphlet, all that type of stuff. And the robot puts it into the box and then closes the box, right? And so a human, and I think they also put like the label sticker on top of it as well, that shipping label thing. You know, before you literally had one person, or, you know, in some cases, a couple of people doing all of that. And now it's all automated and you can scale it up to infinity, or that specific step. So that's a, you know, one little detailed example of kind of how we've just been a lot more thoughtful about how do you actually like build this so that we can scale it.
Yeah, that's huge. And that's exciting that you are able to scale. And it's, I think it's fascinating to understand kind of the manufacturing process, because, you know, there's a lot of people there out there and be like, oh yeah, sure, they're going to, you know, scale up production. It's like, okay, well, this is how they're doing it. So I think it's important to go through that. I do want to talk about, and we've touched on this a little bit already, but the features, okay, the difference between the HDC and the B, and how the, you know, that's going to improve the quality of data. Also with the edge processing, and then talk about, you know, the LTE side of things and the value in getting that data uploaded faster.
Yeah, there's a lot there. So let's start with the positioning, right? And so, at the end of the day, you have to have excellent positioning of the device, because if the device isn't properly localized in the real physical world, then even if you have amazing object detection, even if you have, you know, amazing spatial intelligence, everything is going to be off, right? There's some things that you can do to correct that, obviously, but getting that positioning, you know, at what we consider high quality is lane level positioning, okay? Which is anywhere in the range of, I mean, people have different definitions of this. You know, some people think that's 5 centimeters. I don't think you, in our use case, at least, we don't need 5 centimeters. You know, maybe, you know, down the road we will, but definitely not right now. You know, but we feel very comfortable if we're at, you know, error 50 centimeters one way or another, right? And we're seeing that. And we're seeing that pretty reliably across most of the devices and most of the different regions. There's definitely still going to be issues where, like, you know, you're downtown San Francisco or some other area that you're not going to get 50 centimeter lane level positioning, right? Because of the multipath issue. But anyways, that positioning on this device is just far superior to anything that we've seen. You know, quite frankly, like, I would like to have this in my phone because it's just so much better. That's number one. Number two is that the combination of the main imager, you know, with the compute to be able to do just a tremendous number of object detections, and be able to utilize many, many more frames than we previously were with the HDC. So the HDC had maxed out at roughly like 8 to 9 frames per second, in some cases 10 or 11. Here, we're dealing with 30 frames per second. And so that means is that we just have many, many more opportunities to actually detect objects across many more different frames, right? And so especially when you start to travel at high speeds, that can become an issue when you're only dealing with like 8 or 9, 10 frames per second. And then obviously the stereo depth cameras. So we did have stereo depth cameras on the S model, and we learned a lot from them. The biggest issue with the previous generation was the baseline, which is basically the width between them, was not wide enough. And then the second issue is the quality of the imagers themselves, or the stereo imagers themselves. So we increase the resolution on those to in the B to, I think, 800p. And then it's wider. I think it's 13 centimeters. So that's why the device is wide. So basically the device is thin but wide. So the reason for the width has everything to do with the stereo depth cameras. And what we did was we tried to shrink it down in terms of height, so that just in terms of installing it, like, we felt, and, you know, we'll see what the community feels, we felt that it was better to be thin so that it didn't obstruct your view, right? The big issue with the HiveMapper dash cam was, like, you know, it was just like a block, right? And it obstructed your view. And so we feel like, yes, we've increased the width, but we've made the thing, it's actually 20% thinner than the S, which was already pretty thin as far as dash cams come.
Yeah, no, I think it's good to understand, A, that, you know, the learnings from some of the prior manufacturing, the new features, how the quality of data is going to get better. Yeah, I do want to talk about the LTE, because, yeah. I mean, there are still some questions about that I'm seeing out there about, you know, what the cost of LTE is. I know for one thing, though, with the edge processing, you know, the goal is to select the data that's valuable and upload that data instead of having to upload everything, right? Is that still
yes.
The plan? Yes. Okay. That's correct. Should help as far as how much data needs to be uploaded. But I mean, I'll open the door for you to talk about the LTE versus the Wi-Fi. Is the Wi-Fi still in part, you know, part of the plan moving forward or not? And then, you know, cost of the LTE.
The LTE model, both models will do this, but definitely the LTE model will be more aggressive in terms of selecting only the data that it absolutely wants for the purposes of building the map. Right. So let's break this into categories. So obviously the heaviest data is basically like all imagery, right? And so that's obviously what the Hivemapper dashcam did, was just like all the imagery got uploaded. So that's a lot of data to go through the LTE. Then there is map features. So in other words, speed limit sign, stop sign, turn restriction sign, everything you see around it. That's what we refer to as just the map feature metadata. And then the map feature metadata may also be combined with what's referred to as an image chip, right? Which is just imagine, okay, that speed limit sign, you know, with a little bit of context around it, right? So not the entire image itself, but just like that object with a little bit of context around it so you can understand where it is and all that type of stuff. And so that's a little bit heavier, obviously, because now you're dealing with pixels, which are obviously heavier. But still a tiny, tiny fraction of uploading all imagery. And then the third thing is what's referred to as AI event detections. So this is the vehicle got into some sort of weird situation. Like imagine a kid running into the street, you know, chasing a ball, you slam on the brakes, you know, the car starts to aggressively shake and all that type of crazy stuff. That would be considered an AI event detection, harsh braking. And then it would upload a video segment of anywhere between 10 seconds all the way up to about 90 seconds. So it depends on what the issue is. So that's the third category. Obviously, that can be heavy, but that there's not that many of them. That doesn't happen that frequently. So those are the three categories. And so what's really happening is that the LTE model specifically is managing how much data can't just upload. I mean, you know, tens upon tens of gigs every single month. That's crazy. And so it's trying to manage all those three and say, okay, I need to make sure that I have enough for AI event detections, right? So like, I don't want to use too much of my quota, you know, of my quota, you know, metadata for map features. It's like, you can almost send unlimited, right? Cause it's such a limited amount of data that, you know, like every single one, boom, you can upload. You know, metadata plus image chip, okay, you need to be a little bit more cautious, but not crazy cautious. And then the thing that you need to be the most cautious about is imagery, right? And so that's how we kind of think about it. And you know, just quite frankly, is I think it'll be constant, but I think at least for the first 4 to 6 months of this process, I think that we'll be constantly tuning this, right? To make sure that we're being very, very efficient with that LTE pipe, because we know it's valuable and we know it's costly, right? Yeah. And so we're not, you know, we don't want to be cavalier about this.
Yeah, I imagine that there's, you know, a fine line or kind of this dance, right? You don't want to pull too much data, but you also don't want to miss out on valuable data at the same time, right? So it will take some fine tuning. As far as the LTE plans go, you know, is this something that is going to be open for you to use like Helium if you want, or, you know, AT&T? I mean, are people going to have options? Do you have any idea what the estimated cost is?
Yeah. So in the US, for sure, like you can use Helium. You can use T-Mobile for sure. And, you know, AT&T, I think will probably take, AT&T and Verizon will probably take a little bit longer because they have like a long process in terms of like, you know, going through their crazy, it's not crazy, but it's, they need to validate the device won't cause them any problems fundamentally. Europe is actually a lot easier. Europe is, I think the big player there is Vodafone. So like any network that is on Vodafone should work, you know, immediately, no issues. They don't have like a complicated validation process at all. You know, some of the other carriers, I'd have to kind of look at it one by one. But Australia was the other one they were prioritizing. I forgot which one we chose. I think it's on the website actually. Under tech specs, you'll see like by country or region, you know, which are the supported ones. The short version is Asia and Europe are easier in terms of like us validating. North, you know, Canada, Mexico, US, and Australia are harder. That's like the short version of it. But we want people to obviously have as much choice as possible.
As far as like the cost of the monthly plan, do you have any idea, you know, what that looks like as far as how much data will be needed?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we've seen, I've shared some data about this in Discord. So I think there is like some data floating around there, right? And then people can then say, I think it was like a couple of gigs per month, right? Like two gigs per month or 3 gigs per month. But it's all there in the Discord channel under B device. That was some relatively preliminary, but it's actually, it seems to be holding. You know, look, I just think realistically, there's no world in which like we can get people, nor does it make sense to say like, oh, you need like a 10 gig plan. That's just, you know, kind of off the table for us. Like we wouldn't, and I don't think that's necessary either. I think we're looking to try to keep it within like 1 to 4 gigs per month. That will obviously vary a lot by like where you're driving and a whole bunch of other factors, how much you're driving, et cetera. But that's kind of the sweet spot that we're looking at so that people can say, okay, you know, this data plan that I have is, you know, depending upon which part of the world, it's, you know, $10 a month, it's $15 a month, it's $20 a month. That's kind of like where we would like it to be.
And then as far as the Wi-Fi version, originally that, you know, it seems like we're pushing more for the LTE. Is the Wi-Fi version still in the plans moving forward? Or are you guys potentially scrapping that? What does that look like moving forward, the LTE versus the Wi-Fi version?
Yeah. I mean, okay. Here's my perspective is, like, are there scenarios where the Wi-Fi version makes sense? Yes. Like, I think a couple of people in the Discord community have been pretty adamant, like, look, you know, I can do a hotspot. I already have other, I'm a professional truck driver or whatever it may be. And I already have existing LTE connections in my car or my vehicle. I can just do a quick hotspot from my Wi-Fi from the B Wi-Fi version to this. Why are you forcing me to pay for another LTE plan when I don't really need it, right? I think that's reasonable, okay? I think that's not the vast majority of people also. And so my take on this is, yes, the Wi-Fi has a place in the world, or there are some places in the world where LTE connections still suck, unfortunately, or they're just outrageously expensive, right? Again, there is a role for the Wi-Fi. But I would like to see the Wi-Fi version be a minority percentage of the overall network, and I'll explain to you why. I'm going to put the perspective of the map, right? So if you look at it in the perspective of the map, obviously it wants real-time data, right? And it wants to know like every hour of every day that assuming there's X number of drivers on the road, that those drivers are all uploading real-time. With LTE, that's a pretty good assumption, right? Like if you have, you know, let's just take LA, if there are 5,000 devices that are on the road every single day in the LA region, you know, each driving an average of 3 hours per day, whatever it is, you can rest assured that if the vast majority of those are LTE, then you can be rest assured that you're going to be getting real-time data, right? From, you know, all of those. Well, now let's invert that, right? So now let's say that 90% of those devices in LA, of those 5,000 active devices in LA, are all Wi-Fi. Okay, some of them may be uploading real time, some of them may not, right? But you just don't know, right? Some days people are doing the hotspot thing and sure, you're getting the real time data, which is great, but other times they're not for whatever reason. Or some of them don't do, you know, the hotspot at all, right? And then they're uploading their data an hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hours later, whatever it may be. That fundamentally breaks the system when it comes to, you know, doing all layers of the map. So that's my perspective. You know, a lot of people, will try to like argue with that in terms of like, if my device is providing real-time data from a Wi-Fi, why does it matter to you? That's correct for that specific device, but you have to look at it as a network as a whole, which, you know, if you have a Wi-Fi device, I am very confident, and I've seen this in the data because we have the data today, that the vast majority of them are not uploading real time.
There is going to be a difference in rewards, though, between the LTE and both the HDC and the Wi-Fi. Do you have any idea right now, or is that still kind of being figured out what the difference will be roughly in the reward allocation?
So the short version is that I think the best approach that I've seen is, you know, one that I think Mishmir and then Josh also kind of chimed in as well. It's kind of a combination of a couple different ideas. But basically, if you're driving with a Wi-Fi version, it will basically say, okay, if that Wi-Fi version was uploading at least, let's call it like 95% of the time for that period, for that weekly period, it was uploading in real time, then that will be treated like almost like an LTE version, right? Now, with the caveat that because the LTE version is a little bit more expensive, right, both in terms of the cost of the device as well as the LTE plan, I think that one should still earn a little bit more, but the Wi-Fi version will get pretty damn close to the LTE version, assuming that it is uploading, you know, at least 95% of its data in real time throughout the entire week. And so what that does is it addresses the problem of, okay, this device, we don't want devices that are kind of, you know, one day they're uploading real time, the next day they're not. Like, that inconsistency is what we're trying to head off. And so this incentivizes people to basically be consistent. And so, you know, maybe the hotspot, you know, like, hey, you already have a fixed LTE thing in there. Boom, it's hotspotted into that. Boom, every time you get into the vehicle, it all works and it's uploading. Okay. Like, again, I think that's a minority of users, but if that's what's working for you, then yes, you'll earn pretty close to an LTE, but not 100% of the LTE.
That's good. I'm sure people were wondering about that. The last thing before we move on from the B, there's been talk off and on about the potential for mapping at night. Is that something you're still looking at?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it won't upload imagery. I mean, it won't use the imagery at night, but in terms of being able to detect objects. Okay, so here's what we're seeing in the test is that if you're in a city, right, with just a lot of light from, you know, the street lights and all the buildings and all that type of stuff, then you can actually get a fair amount of the objects, et cetera, right? If you're driving in a rural area with no, you know, city lights, street lights, et cetera, then you generally just get what's directly in front of you. In other words, you know, the light from the vehicles lighting up the signs and all the other type of stuff, you know, that is when you can, you know, you'll start to be able to detect those type of stuff. So there will be differences based upon where you're driving in terms of probably your total rewards. But yeah, like, we definitely want people driving at night with this thing. There's a lot of value in terms of, like, you know, crazy shit happens at night, right? Like, road construction happens at night. A lot of other things happen at night. You know, we want to be able to see it, understand it, and then boom, share it with the map.
I know I've been wondering about that. I'm sure people in the community have been wondering about that. So I want to move into the regulatory environment because for the first time ever, really, for crypto, especially in the U.S., it seems that we have a clear path for innovation and crypto in the U.S. And I'll add, I've read, and I'll let you state whether it's true or not, the new crypto czar, if you will, David Sacks, was an early investor in Hivemapper. Is that true?
That is true.
Okay. The thing I'm most curious about, though, is, you know, how is this regulatory environment looking forward going to change things potentially for Hivemapper?
Okay, I want to be very careful here. I'm not speaking for David Sacks. I have not had any conversations with David recently about this topic. So what I'm sharing with you is my own perspective. And obviously, I agree with a lot of what David Sacks is trying to do. All right, let's start with, like, super high level. There's a lot of new technologies in the world, and I think it is absolutely critical for the United States to be the leader in those new technologies. The only way you become the leader in those technologies is if you allow entrepreneurs, communities, you know, like the one that we have here with Hivemapper that's so amazing, to experiment, right? Experimentation, there's going to be a lot of ideas. Some of them are going to work, some of them aren't going to work. But fundamentally, you have to run through that experimentation process. And so the issue with the prior administration was they were not allowing that experimentation to happen, right? There are a lot of frauds and other crap and scams in the crypto. And I really wish that they would have spent their time going after that stuff rather than going after the real projects, the real businesses, the real interesting technologies, you know, whether it be things like Ethereum, whether it be things like Coinbase and many others, right? You know, my perspective now is under this new Trump administration is that it finally gives us the opportunity to run those experiments, right? And many of them, like every other technology in the world, many of them will not be successful, but there will be some that will be incredibly successful. And those will be the things that are the next Googles of the world, the next Apples of the world, et cetera. Or even the next JP Morgans of the world, right? And so I think that is what's finally happening here. And so that's part one. Part two is I don't think many people appreciated in the community, at least in the HiveMapper community, that projects like HiveMapper, others like Helium, maybe even Render, et cetera, that they are based in the United States, right? Like the core teams for HiveMapper is based in the United States. The core team for Helium is based in the United States. The same for Render, et cetera, right? And that really, really limited what we could do, right? Even just limited the words we could use, et cetera, right? And we were effectively just fighting with one hand tied behind our back. And so we're finally allowing this innovation engine as it relates to crypto, finally unleashing it, right? And finally allowing it to go and build new products and build new services in the crypto world. And so that's very, very exciting. And you know, I think it's great for America. I think it's great for the HiveMapper community. And this is the most important thing that's happened to HiveMapper, quite frankly, in the last 12 months.
That's a big statement, man. I have to say, I agree. Because look, blockchain technology is going to be a huge part of our lives moving forward. I think that there's this revolution happening right now, not just in the finance sector, but you know, DPIN's a great example of real productivity, right? And real use cases that are you know leverage that blockchain technology. So having a clear path, being able to actually build, hopefully attracting more people into the US to build here is very exciting. And overall, I mean, look, everything you're doing with HiveMapper, very exciting. I know we're coming up on time here, but you know, the revenue trends, the B, as stated earlier, February is what we're targeting for full on production, but you know, obviously the shipments are about to start going out here. So very exciting. And I think that the future is very bright, man. And the other thing I'll say is you and your team, I mean, obviously you've been mapping for a long time, but you guys are working around the clock. You're very, very committed. You know, the same can't be said of all projects out there, but you all do a really good job of, you know, constantly grinding, getting these tools built. Where we're at now compared to 2 years ago, I mean, night and day, it's been a really cool journey to be a part of. And I think I told you this, you know, I got the inspiration for my YouTube channel when I was in San Francisco. We were sitting in the office and you're asking me like, you know, early days of HiveMapper, you're like, hey, so how are you building your fleet? And I gave you my whole, you know, pitch I was using with Uber and Lyft drivers. And, you know, I was out there for a wedding and I remember being at the wedding that night thinking to myself like, man, that I need to create a YouTube channel, you know, and try to get the word out there and help other people get in this space. So I remember that moment very clearly. Hard to believe it was a couple of years ago now. But yeah, as always, I really appreciate having you on. Curious if there's anything else you want to add before we cut off here.
No, I think this has been an amazing conversation. I want to thank you, Brad, for everything you've done for the HiveMapper community. I always appreciate you as a voice of thoughtfulness and reason. You know, communities, especially like one like ours, you know, you got a lot of, you know, high passion, high emotion one way or another. And I think like you've always kind of brought this even keeled approach to it, which is much appreciated. So appreciate everything you've done for the community. And, you know, love to see that your channel here is gaining traction, which is fun to see.
It is. You're one of my first subscribers. So, it's cool to see it's growing. Hopefully it continues on that path. But man, as always, Ariel, I appreciate the time.
Thank you.